The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Advancing Patient Care in Chronic Spontaneous Urticaria, Reshaping the Future with Targeted Biologic Therapies. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/RFB860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for being here tonight. I want to thank you for spending your night with us. I know you have a lot of different options, and I can assure you with Dr. Lee here that that you've had made the right choice for the program tonight. And I also want to welcome, there are also virtual attendees that are online watching us, so welcome to those attendees as well. We're very excited today to talk to you about chronic spontaneous urticaria. And I think it's really an area that as dermatologists, we can learn a lot more in thinking about how we can bring it back almost to our wheelhouse. And specifically, we're going to talk about some of the targeted biologic therapies in this particular area. So my name is April Armstrong, and I am professor and chief of dermatology at UCLA. And I'll have Dr. Lee introduce himself.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Jason Lee, clinical immunologist allergist practicing in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm happy to be in the sun here in San Diego.
Yes, and we're happy to have an allergist crashing our party here. So a few goals tonight. Hopefully we're going to talk about some of the signs and symptoms of CSU and also talk about definition of CSU. In addition to that, we'll talk about some of the pathogenesis, and I'm really excited to hear Dr. Lee's perspective on this, as well as some of the targeted biologic therapies that we use to treat CSU. We're also going to talk about some of the measures that we have in clinical trials that measure the severity of chronic spontaneous urticaria. And hopefully with that knowledge, I think in the future, we're able to better interpret and evaluate data on new therapies for chronic spontaneous urticaria. Here's me. And my part, I'm going to talk about how we can improve the diagnosis of chronic spontaneous urticaria. All right. So when we think about chronic spontaneous urticaria, and I think the nomenclature has kind of evolved over time. And first of all, the word chronic is really looking at urticaria that stays around for greater than 6 weeks. So as you know, by definition, urticaria itself, if you look at individual lesions, they're supposed to disappear within 24 hours. But the grouping them together are typically lasting chronically greater than 6 weeks for it to qualify as chronic part of the chronic spontaneous urticaria. And then urticaria then is classified into either spontaneous, where we cannot find any specific eliciting factors, or inducible. I remember the time when it's used to call it a chronic idiopathic urticaria. How many of you remember that? Okay, yeah, several hands came up. So these days we kind of have categorized into spontaneous or inducible. And the inducible urticarias are the ones that we typically think about. For example, dermatographism, where we scratch their back and see if the patient hives in that area, cold urticaria, solar urticaria, heat urticaria, vibratory angioedema, a cholinergic urticaria, and also rarely aquagenic urticaria. So something where we can identify a cause. Whereas spontaneous urticaria, we cannot have an identifiable cause. And when we look at chronic spontaneous urticaria in terms of the prevalence, for example, it is thought that up to 1% of the population may be affected with this condition. And when we look at the female versus male distribution, women are actually twice as likely as men to have CSU. And if you think about clinical presentation of patients in your clinic, you probably can recall in your head as well, you may have a bit more presentation from women as compared to men. And when we look at the duration, we talked about to qualify for that, you have to be 6 weeks or greater. And in terms of presentation, about 61% of them only have hives. 33% of them have hives as well as somewhat localized or generalized swelling, and only 6% of them have only swelling with no hives. So I think the diagnosis of CSU is very much a clinical one. And as dermatologists, I think we're actually pretty good at recognizing hives. However, that being said, I think a careful history and physical exam, asking about those inducible factors that we talked about early, heat, cold, and a number of others that we discuss, is very important to rule out, for example, the inducible causes of urticaria. But there is a diagnostic algorithm that has been published that looks at the diagnosis of a chronic urticaria. Few things to note is that patients with chronic spontaneous urticaria can present with both wheals or angioedema. Most of them will present with wheals only, but they can present with wheals or angioedema. And I'll kind of go over this flow chart a little bit. So if you look at the left-hand side, when they have these wheals, which is the primary, oftentimes the most common presentation, you want to note the average wheal duration, for example. Are the symptoms inducible coming to CSU? If they also have angioedema signs or symptoms, you do want to look for a few different things. For example, are they on an ACE inhibitor? And as we know, ACE inhibitors can potentially, in a small population of patients, lead to angioedema. If they're not on the ACE inhibitor, then you want to rule out, are there causes of hereditary or acquired angioedema? And if that workup is negative, and then you look at if the symptoms are inducible or not inducible. So those, both of these signs and symptoms can all lead ultimately to CSU. I think the main thing is that if you have a patient who also present with angioedema, you do need some additional workup and then check their medication history, make sure that they're not on an ACE inhibitor, make sure they don't have other potential, they may have diagnosis of HAE or AAE before thinking and classifying them into CSU. What are some of the associated clinical symptoms of CSU? While they may present to us with hives, they may have other symptoms. Sometimes they may present concurrently with joint pain. Some patients report also flushing or breathlessness sometimes, headache and fatigue. Some may even present with some gastrointestinal symptoms and potentially palpitations. So there are these symptoms that may be associated with chronic spontaneous urticaria that goes beyond the skin. And then when we look at differential diagnosis of chronic spontaneous urticaria, there are a number of them. And we oftentimes, I think, as dermatologists, I think the one that we oftentimes ponder about are something like urticarial vasculitis, because they can present morphologically identical, for example, to urticaria, and oftentimes a biopsy may sometimes be informative in those situations. Also, for example, early presentations of bullous pemphigoid before it becomes bullous can oftentimes also present with this urticarial-like presentation. There are a number of other conditions, and maybe I'll pause here for a little bit. I did not warn Dr. Lee about this, but I would love to hear his thoughts on this. On this list is mast cell activation syndrome. Now, I don't know about my derm colleagues here. I feel like every time I send someone to an allergist colleague, they come back with a diagnosis of mast cell activation syndrome. So I was thinking maybe you can tell us about differentiating between CSU and mast cell activation syndrome, or what your thoughts on that is.
Yeah, so mast cell activation syndrome is a diagnosis of exclusion. So once you have, you know, the diagnosis of CSU, that is your primary diagnosis typically. And mast cell activation syndrome would not be the diagnosis. So typically, I think it is often overused, because if you have an alternative diagnosis, that is the diagnosis, but it has become a very popular diagnosis in, you know, alternative medicine and among some of my colleagues. But oftentimes when I see consults for this, and this is something I see on a daily basis, second or third opinion for MCAS, often there is an alternative explanation that is much more likely and that is manageable. So those are my thoughts on it personally. And it's important to rule out everything beforehand.
Great, wonderful. This is the first time Dr. Lee and I share a stage, so I'm putting him on in the hot seat here. Wonderful. So, okay, so let's talk about routine testing. How many of you do laboratory workup for your patients with chronic spontaneous urticaria? By show of hands. Okay, many of you do. And so it's really interesting because I think our when I was trained, I was also trained on doing a number of different laboratory testing. But I think the literature on this has evolved a little bit. And I'll show you some of the utility data a little bit later on. These days, it seems like perhaps targeted laboratory testing is helpful, but perhaps extensive laboratory testing may not be as helpful according to our latest findings. So there are things that one can consider. In general, these days, laboratory testing is thought to be actually not to be very helpful in patients with CSU. There are some association with thyroid disease, and so sometimes what I will do, I will check if the patient hasn't had their thyroid check, I will check thyroid function test to make sure that that they do not have that. It's a small proportion of patients, but it is something that I consider. And I wanted to get your thoughts, Dr. Lee, on in terms of laboratory testing, what do you do, and what your recommendations on that might be.
Yeah, so generally I follow the World Allergy Organization guidelines on what to test for in terms of the screening laboratory investigations. The thought is, though, however, usually when I do see patients' second or third opinion consults, the expectation, unfortunately, from one of my patients on a practical level is to do more extensive workup. And now the evidence on and grade quality of different types of investigations are very controversial. And sometimes, you know, you cannot make a cost-effective analysis on this. So, for example, you know, a serum protein electrophoresis to look out for something like myeloma. You know, I may diagnose about 3 to 4 MGUS, so that's, you know, M protein of undetermined significance. But the true incidence of, you know, myeloma, I've diagnosed 1 every 6 or 7 years. So is that enough yield to warrant this systemic screening? So people at the WAO and when they vote on consensus guidelines, you know, have a open vote system in terms of what investigations they should. I think I generally agree with their recommendations, although, you know, the only one I can say I don't quite agree with is the CRP and ESR, because you're really using that to rule out urticarial vasculitis, which you can get on history. And the fact of the matter is, in just plain old CSU, 30 to 40% of them will have an elevated, you know, CRP and ESR anyways. So does that really affect my management? You know, you may have similar initiatives in your jurisdiction and countries of choosing wisely. If an intervention or a test does not affect your management, is it really worthwhile? And I think you're going to speak to more about this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, during the time when I was trained, closer to 20 years ago now, you know, we're used to checking CBC and CRP, ESR, but then we recognize that, like you said, about, you know, 40% of the patients would be have elevated. Are you treating that lab? Probably not. And I think one area that we often as derms have debate over is whether to check, for example, skin or serum specific IgE levels, IgE testing, actually. What are your thoughts for that?
Yeah, so there's, you know, two studies that show that there might be a predictive biomarker basis of looking at the ratio of total IgE. So this is IgE in your serum in the blood versus the anti-TPO IgG antibody. And this was selected because it's the one that's, you know, highly associated, but also that most people have access to in terms of ordering on a practical level. So the ratio of this, so the higher the IgG level you have, tends to mean that you may have the IgE, the allergy antibody to the TPO. And using that ratio, you can somehow discern whether or not there is a type of autoimmune component, a self-allergen, so to speak. So there is some value in this, and this is recommended and mentioned in the consensus guidelines. You know, but we got to reproduce and be able to find more evidence like this.
Great. So let's look at some of the cost utility data. So on the blue box you see are some of the cost effective analysis, but I want you to focus on the bottom, which is the gray box, where they looked at a cohort study looking at the cost utility of routine testing. And essentially, greater than 90% of those were within normal limits. And in addition, what's not listed here is that out of 725 patients with thousands of tests done, they determined there was only one test that actually changed the management. So, so I think that was quite instructive. And maybe just to be clear, do you recommend any routine, like on everyone with CSU, is there one test? If there's only one test you can order, Jason, which one would you choose?
Oh, that's a really tough one. One test. I would say CBC and differential, if that counts as one test.
Okay, great. And what would you do if it's?
It's really to give us a clue sometimes. So, you know, it may be a rough screen for lymphoma, but it would really be a screening. Does this patient have a tendency for type 2 inflammation like eosinophilia? Or do they have something else going on, like do they have a neutropenia or neutrophilia? And that would kind of give me an idea of what direction to put my next set of investigations, including the lymphocyte count too.
Great, great. All right. Excellent. Now let's continuing on and learn about some of the scales in order to measure disease activity. And I do think this is something that is a little bit foreign to dermatologists and or many of us, you know, who may not deal with this scale constantly unless you're doing clinical trials. So we have the UAS score, which is essentially a validated scoring system that measures urticaria activity severity. And it consists of two components, wheals and itch. And you score them really depends on the severity. One thing when I first learned about this scale that I was impressed with is that mild is less than 20 wheals. I think 20 wheals is actually quite a bit, and moderate is 20 to 50 wheals. So if you can imagine a patient being covered with that many wheals, you can imagine how uncomfortable that they may be. And so what you do is that you take the wheal number and the itch severity score, and then you have them score daily. So they get a daily score, and then you add up the daily score to a weekly score. That's why it's called UAS-7, and it ranges from 0 to 42, with a higher number representing more severe disease. You may also encounter something called the UCT, which is urticaria control test, and this is a measure of how well our patients think their urticaria is controlled. And it's scored on four different domains. Number one is the physical symptoms of urticaria. Number two is their quality of life. Number three is their treatment. How often do they think their treatment, how well do they think their treatment is helping them? And number four is sort of an overall domain of looking at overall how well they think their symptoms are under control. And you get these different points, and essentially where you have complete control is where you have 16 points, and you get less and less points if you have poor control. So this is very important. I know in the allergy world where you look at their scoring to determine whether you may want to change therapies. All right, there are a number of things that can actually modify disease activity or exacerbate disease activity. Things like food intolerance, drug intolerance, stress, or chronic infections can all affect that. And then I think our group is very familiar with the impact of chronic spontaneous urticaria on patients' quality of life. They can't sleep. They can't work effectively. They really do not like the unpredictability of the attacks, and the itch is very bothersome. And therefore, you notice that the impact on sleep from CSU is very, very significant. They have problems falling asleep, they have problems staying asleep, and they oftentimes wake up too early as well. We are looking at, I think as a field, different ways of measuring quality of life in CSU. And I think most of these efforts are oftentimes in combination with our allergy colleagues. We're familiar with DLQI, Dermatology Quality Life Index, which has been used to measure CSU, but more of a skin-specific quality of life measure. We have SkinDex 29 developed by Dr. Kren, and looking again at skin-specific. But then we also have a number of more CSU-specific quality of life measures, including chronic urticaria quality measure, as well as chronic urticaria patient perspective measure. So there are these other measurements. The main thing for this talk is for us to be aware that there are disease-specific quality of life measures to help us measure our patients' quality of life as a result of having CSU. And with that, I'm going to pass this, the baton, to Dr. Lee.
All right, thank you very much. So I'm Jason Lee. I'm a clinical immunologist allergist in Canada, Toronto. Prior to medical school, my specialty was actually in immunology, so that's a lot of basic science and both lab work and theoretical work. So I've been obsessing about immunology, allergy for pretty much most of my adult life. Gives me a bit of a unique perspective. Just like you guys, I also see patients. I'm a clinician as well as a clinical researcher. So I'm going to talk to you about the basic consideration in the management of CSU. Obviously, the goal of treatment, ideally gold standard, get rid of the hives. But we want to improve that patient's quality of life, get them to function again. We want to do this safely and as efficiently as possible. The therapeutic approach in terms of this, okay, treat underlying and eliminate causes. The number of consults that I get where the only intervention I do is, do you take any NSAIDs like Advil, ibuprofen, Motrin? That's the only thing I remove is this, and the hive sometimes goes away. Well-known dose-dependent side effect. Avoidance of eliciting factors. Dr. Armstrong mentioned dietary measures. The main dietary measures that I look for are things like spicy food. We don't have receptors for spice, for taste. We experience them through pain and stress. So your body thinks it's stress, can trigger hives. Sometimes a lot of strawberries, if you eat a lot of them, they have got lectins, can cause hives. Alcohol, if you consider that a food, can trigger hives. It's a non-specific mast cell degranulator. So these are the main factors that I ask for there. Tolerance induction, using what have they tried before, and all sorts of alternative medicines do exist, so we want to ask for those too. The most common one I hear about outside of antihistamines are things like quercetin, which is naturally occurring, but in 1/100th of the quantity in an actual apple. Then we want to treat. We want to do maximizing quality of life with the littlest treatment, the littlest side effects. Very obvious first principle there. Drugs, physical stimuli, eradicate infectious and inflammatory conditions. As I mentioned before when I was answering Dr. Armstrong's question, is there any intervention or labs that would affect your management? Sometimes there are, but it has to be like directed investigation. Reduce emotional and physical stress. I always joke to my patients, I cannot cure your stress, you've got to win a lottery ticket. But, stress we find is a very important part of CSU. Some of the new therapeutics are involved, but some of the mental health models on anxiety and depression are actually turns out to be neuroinflammatory. So, then dietary again. Chronic urticaria, management decisions and treatment adjustments, okay? So in my day-to-day clinical practice, I do not use the urticaria control or any scoring system. If a patient gives me a high five, I joke and say, high five, they're doing well, okay? For a clinical study, of course, and to be more formal, we have to use validated scoring systems like the urticaria control test, like the UAS7. However, these do give us an opportunity to objectively assess and adjust therapy, whether stepping up or down as we see fit, to kind of maximize our pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic interventions. These are the antihistamines that I found that are used very commonly in the US. We want to stick to second generation antihistamines. First generation antihistamines, at least in Canada, we've had a professional society push to try to remove a lot of them. We find that they interfere with sleep quality, even though you feel more drowsy, and a lot of your body needs that restful sleep to kind of recover. So although we want to use antihistamine, try to avoid the sedating ones. You're actually not doing the patient a favor because their quality of sleep goes down. Cetirizine, levocetirizine, fexofenadine, loratadine, desloratadine, very commonly used. As a rule of thumb, one pill is one dose. and you can go up to 4, but of course, double check if it's extra strength or a prescription. H1 antihistamines, okay, this is, we're referring to H1 blockers, the main block receptor on the skin. This is enough for some people, but not for all people. Okay, even at quadruple the dose, the best studies show a control rate of about 60%, okay, maybe up to 50. We want to generalize the magnitude, and it's hard to generalize the magnitude effect sometimes. RCTs, okay, show that both first and second generation antihistamines do help. But again, I'm telling you, try to avoid the second, oh, sorry, try to only use the second generation. And this is within the consensus guidelines that I largely follow. Okay, we want to improve quality of life. That's what it comes down to. Let's get these patients going. Strengths and limitations of guidelines, okay? There are many strengths. Before there was, you know, all sorts of different nomenclature, we made things much more evidence-based. It's consensus-driven. It's international. We have a stepwise approach, generally with the principle and maxim of not having the patient exposed to excessive risk and balancing that risk-benefit profile. We want to emphasize that, you know, it's individual. There's a lot of individual variation in this. There are some limitations too, though, okay? There's no consensus on labs, as Dr. Armstrong mentioned. Okay, none are universally helpful, although there's an over 90% consensus on the Galen and WAO guidelines. Again, one of the criticisms is an open vote system. If you have to get invited to these guidelines, you're not going to dissent from the group, which is, I think, a major consideration. There's lack of rigorous data for alternative treatments, okay, beyond omalizumab and cyclosporin. There's management is challenged when you follow stepwise guidance, and you know, some people just don't like the cookbook kind of approach to treatment. Limited data for response to therapies, like how quickly can we escalate? When is considered a failure? When do we, you know, pull the trigger on trying something new? So this is really based on a lot of trial and error approach. CSU is driven by the allergist's favorite cell, the mast cell. It's a very primitive part of our immune system, okay? Very similar to the basophil. We have a lot more mast cells compared to basophils, though, but easier to study basophils in blood because they're in the blood as opposed to tissue. There are many receptors. So oftentimes when I get a referral, it's to actually skin test a patient for an allergy because the only thing that they may remember from medical school is the IgE part, okay? That's the allergy antibody and the receptor. It turns out that there are many other ways that the cell can get turned on. And one thing I want to take away here is that you got to think about what is the function of the mast cell? If your body is a country, this is border security. Anywhere where there's an interface between you and the outside world, it's going to want to know about. So it has baroreceptors to detect things coming into your skin. It can detect temperature differences. It does respond to psychological stress, okay? Other activating signals, if you're fighting an infection, you want complement receptors on this thing because you want it to augment and help in the fight. So this is border patrol. We've got other things that can sometimes go wrong. People can develop cross-linking antibodies to different parts of the receptor. But central to all this, and I think the big conceptual breakthrough is that chronic spontaneous urticaria, although there may be many paths toward this, is largely driven by IL-4, 5, and 13, the type 2 inflammatory cytokines. Now, you know, when I first started talking about this, I said, no, that's eczema, it's not urticaria. And this is kind of the story that everyone had. Urticaria is very different from urticaria. You know, largely the skin is intact, but the central drivers and what propagates urticaria is actually a very similar immune dysregulation that involves the same cytokines. So you've got Th2, mast cells, basophils, eosinophils, but all of these effector cells like mast cells and eosinophils can also propagate and start this reaction as well. So these patients have the same cytokine elevations that your AD patients will have. Everyone focuses on histamine, but I'm going to show you a few other things here. When this cell gets turned on, okay, with the signaling of IL-4 or 13, you're producing more allergy antibodies, the IgE antibody. So that is making you know, things like autoantigens. So, I always explain and joke to my patients, you can actually be allergic to yourself. This is a huge conceptual breakthrough that occurred in 2011 from the Zuberbier and Marcus Maurer, the German group. But we had the technology to detect the difference between IgG and IgE antibody. They're very similar in size. You need a very specific assay that can ascertain the two. And once we did that, we had a kind of a breakthrough. Let me take you through the story, because there is a Toronto connection where I'm from. Dr. Arthur Lazanov was actually my allergist. And he first noticed that patients with CSU have this association with hypothyroidism. In 1986, a few years later, people looking at hives, they were able to take a serum out of a patient, inject it, and it re-elicited a hive. So these patients were reacting to something within their own blood. Late 80s and early 90s, we found that some people actually develop a cross-linking IgG antibody to their Fc epsilon R1 receptor, which is the IgE receptor. That didn't explain most of hives, though. So over time, we find that hives can be, the mast cell can be triggered not just by allergies, but by so many things. One of the common things that I see are people who like the spicy food, caspasin. There's actually caspasin receptors. People who smoke marijuana. Prior to legalization in Canada, nobody ever admitted that they smoke marijuana or consume cannabis products. But now that it's legal, I find a lot of these patients are actually taking daily marijuana. And that intervention, asking them to cut down, helps quite a bit. Stress, infections, COVID infections, much more likely to drive type 2 inflammation as well. So we've got all these things, and many, many cytokines are involved. One thing I did want to highlight are, you know, things like stem cell factor. And again, if you use that border analogy with a country, if there's a border breach, they're going to call for reinforcements. They temporarily immortalize the existing mast cells and call for more from the bone marrow. So you got things like GM-CSF that increase as well. So fast forward to 2011, and I was mind blown with this study. Okay, they found a very specific assay that could differentiate IgE and IgG. Because most of the body's antibody is IgG, it's almost impossible to discern out the IgE. Once they found this, they took the patients who had urticaria and found that, hey, a lot more of these patients actually have a self-antibody to IgE, to the thyroid peroxidase. Thyroid peroxidase is an interesting enzyme. It's also found and very similar to myeloperoxidase in your white blood cells as well. So it may not have much to do with the thyroid hormone level, the TSH, but the antibody, so the anti-TPO or even sometimes anti-thyroglobulin, can be a driver of mast cell activity. Now if we fast forward to 2018, now that more places have this assay, we found that patients with CSU are much more likely to have immune systems that have made an autoantibody, IgE, not IgG, to their own self. People who develop anaphylactic reactions are also more likely to get this too, compared to healthy controls. Healthy controls, you make a few mistakes, but again, it's a synergy effect. Maybe if you've got too many things to react to, the cell will degranulate and you get hives. So underlying mechanisms and therapeutic targets for CSU, there's many of them. This is where, I think immunology is the basis for understanding every disease condition, but knowing what receptors and how the cell operates allows us to plan and further future therapies. So I just had our Quad AI conference, and I think you'll hear about the readout from the tezepelumab study on CSU. I never imagined that it would have any effect. It missed the primary endpoint, but it seemed that even these patients, when they stopped the medication, they may actually continue to have reduced hive activity. So again, it really challenged. Sometimes therapy really does drive our understanding of these conditions, but many, many therapies are potentially being studied. And I'm going to talk to you more about the dupilumab data and some of the other data here. But our understanding is really challenged by some therapeutics. So we've got a little video here to show you the role of type 2 inflammation in CSU.
Chronic spontaneous urticaria, or CSU, is a mast cell-driven skin disease characterized by the recurrence of transient wheals, also referred to as hives, angioedema, or both for more than 6 weeks. Several mechanisms have been investigated as possibly contributing to the pathogenesis of CSU, including infections, food intolerance, coagulation cascade, genetic factors, and autoimmunity. In type 1 autoimmune CSU, IgE autoantibodies to autoantigens, such as thyroid peroxidase and interleukin-24, activate mast cells to secrete vasoactive mediators, cytokines, and chemokines. These, in turn, activate endothelial cells, increase vascular permeability, and promote the migration of blood cells to the dermis. In type 2B and 3 autoimmune CSU, IgG autoantibodies to the IgE receptor, or IgE itself, activate mast cells with the same consequences. Two IgG molecules in proximity activate complement type 3 to liberate C5a, which augments mast cell secretion and is a separate chemotactic factor for granulocytes and monocytes. The rationale for the development of new agents to be tested for putative efficacy in CSU is dependent on assumptions about which of the aforementioned contributions to hive formation can be inhibited to significantly suppress symptoms. New biologics that are currently under development for the treatment of patients with chronic urticaria aim to reduce mast cell activation. By blocking activating pathways or engaging inhibitory receptors or mast cell numbers. Biologics that are currently approved for other conditions are also being evaluated for the treatment of chronic spontaneous urticaria. Dupilumab is a fully human monoclonal antibody that inhibits the signaling of the IL-4 and IL-13 pathways. IL-4 and IL-13 are key and central drivers of the type 2 inflammation that plays a role in asthma, chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis, atopic dermatitis, eosinophilic esophagitis, prurigo nodularis, and CSU. In 2022, parts A and B of a pivotal phase 3 trial were completed, with part A meeting its primary endpoints and all key secondary endpoints at 24 weeks, showing that the addition of dupilumab to standard of care antihistamines significantly reduced itch and hives for biologic-naive patients compared with those treated with antihistamines alone. Part C of the phase 3 trial is ongoing. IL-5 may contribute to the pathogenesis of chronic spontaneous urticaria by direct effects on skin mast cells and by promoting the recruitment of eosinophils and basophils to skin sites of wheal development. Eosinophils and basophils are elevated in the lesional skin of patients with CSU, where they bidirectionally interact with mast cells. Furthermore, high disease activity in CSU is linked to eosinopenia and basopenia. The development and launch of novel agents for chronic spontaneous urticaria are encouraging for patients unresponsive to current treatments. As newer biological agents become available, clinicians need to understand both the target and therapeutic mechanism in order to better select appropriate patients for these therapies.
Okay, and the recommended treatment algorithm. So I think I largely follow this in my day-to-day clinical practice. And, you know, at least where I practice in Canada, I often have to write and reassure the pharmacist it's okay. Four times the dose is going to be okay. Because that's the biggest resistance that I run into. And, you know, almost all my patients, when I discuss cyclosporine, they don't really want to even try it or consider it. So, you know, we typically play around with omalizumab dosing and interval if it doesn't respond. You know, I was very happy to try dupilumab when I first was starting to use it for atopic dermatitis, but other clinical trials and other clinical trial drugs, like I said, really challenge our understanding. Treating a common precursor, for example, may actually help as well that affect eosinophils. So approved off-label and novel systemic therapies for chronic urticaria. It's a good time to be an immunologist or if you have an interest because you get to kind of see this stuff in action. Omalizumab, dupilumab, even benralizumab, okay, that targets interleukin-5, secukinumab, remibrutinib, rizolobutinib, tezepelumab, lirentinumab, there are many, barvozilumab, but many, many things are going to come out and many, some things earlier than others, some things may fail, but it's a very interesting time. Current treatment options are not effective for achieving full disease control. So, you know, this is the biggest issue that I had. So with omalizumab, if you treat enough urticaria, and I'm sure there are many of you like me who have hundreds of patients who may have been tried on omalizumab, but some of them just do not respond. So what we see that in meta-analysis, only about 60% of patients, 55, 60, will respond to omalizumab after they've already done the four times antihistamine and adding a biologic omalizumab. So some patients remain uncontrolled in spite of the current approved biologic. Okay, and that's from the 60% that don't achieve control from antihistamine. So there's a lot of challenges to managing CSU patients, okay? And, you know, a lot of times patients do not like them because they don't feel that it works. They do not feel that it helps. Of course, there are other reasons as well. But omalizumab for refractory CSU, these are the omalizumab trials, Asteria 1, 2, and 3. 1 and 2 are dosing studies, as well as placebo in 24 and 12 weeks. And Galatia was a 24-week trial, which showed that omalizumab can help in these patients. But when we look at the data, a portion of responders by treatment group, okay, in these trials, you see from the data from these trials that not everyone achieves what we consider a response. And response is defined a little bit differently, but a common one is a UAS7 score under 6. Why do many patients fail to benefit? Well, I think like asthma and other conditions that I treat, like atopic dermatitis, you know, dermatitis, it's kind of driven by many factors sometimes, not one thing, but it has a similar clinical manifestation. So the inflammatory pathway may not quite fit the IgE and Fc epsilon R1 receptor here. So it fails to completely control symptoms in a large percentage of patients, 30 to 60%. Okay, we talked a little bit about this, the TPO and IgE, the IgG, TPO and IgE levels to maybe predict a response, a biomarker approach. And cyclosporin, a very high dose is recommended who don't respond to omalizumab, but there has to be better options. There's a lot of unmet needs in CSU treatment. Better treatments are needed, clearly. And most interventional agents look at blocking or inhibiting mast cell activation or silencing mast cells or deplete mast cells. But I think regulating the imbalance or dysregulation of the immune system is actually also critical as well. A treatment challenge is identifying which drugs are most likely to be given to a patient, identification of reliable and easily analyzed biomarkers to predict response. So I think the biomarkers could be improved upon from currently where they are. This is really exciting data, phase 3, CSU, and using dupilumab to treat CSU, overview of CUPID. So the design was you had to be 12 and up, and you were refractory to H1 antihistamine. It was a randomized, double-blind, parallel assignment, placebo-controlled study. Part A was you were naive to omalizumab, never seen it in your life. Study B was that you were either intolerant or non-responder to omalizumab. A and B had two arms, the dupilumab active treatment versus placebo, okay? This is on top of your baseline therapy. And the endpoints were the endpoints of standardized metrics like UAS, ISS7, and other sort of standardized validated scoring systems. So results, 138 patients were enrolled, and 63% had a reduction in itch severity with dupilumab versus 35 as standard of care. Okay, so this is a 10.2 reduction in dupilumab with a 6-point reduction in standard of care. And if you look at urticaria activity, okay, which was a primary endpoint in, by EMA, 65% reduction in dupilumab versus 37. Similar numbers in the itch severity and the UAS scoring you see there. But this is a 20-point reduction with dupilumab and a 12-point reduction with standard of care. So safety, we don't see too many new safety signals that you saw in the other indications of dupilumab. Occurrence of treatment-related events were similar between the two groups, 50 versus 59, okay, in the placebo. Most common adverse events were injection site reactions. We all get these from every sort of injection drug we use. When we look at phase 3 trial results from CUPID-B, okay, so this did not meet its endpoint. There was a trend towards significance, but the treatment dosage during the 24 weeks, okay, again, it was exactly like Part A, but you had been exposed to omalizumab before either as a non-responder or an intolerant person. So it didn't reach analysis, which is really interesting because when I had published prior to this trial, that the patients who had enrolled had all actually failed omalizumab. So I was kind of surprised to see this data. So recent data from the Quad AI that was released from our conference just before yours, okay, so it was post hoc data on the CUPID study, CUPID Part A patients who succeeded to meet their primary endpoint. And we look at quality of life domains. Again, this is a very important part in what we, you know, what I want to do as a physician is that most of these patients, 60, 69%, reported they were not or only a little bit bothered by their hives and itching compared to 37% for placebo. At week 24, 53% of patients received a UAS score less than 6 and 35% UAS is 0, so nothing at all versus much lower rates of placebo. When you discontinue dupilumab by week 24, the interesting thing is that unlike omalizumab, where patients often trend back to having hives again, okay, a lot of patients who received dupilumab, even though they had stopped, continue to actually do it okay. So other ongoing studies of dupilumab in CSU, okay, study C, this is ongoing. I'm a site for this as well. We looked at efficacy of dupilumab in study participants with CSU. It's exactly like part A, okay? And there's another one, Liberty CSU Cupid Kids, and looking at children, 2 to 12. Not as common in children, but you know, children get CSU as well. This is really interesting from our Quad AI conference, tezepelumab. I would have thought they would not have any activity in CSU because the epithelium is largely intact in CSU versus atopic dermatitis. This is an alarmin, which is a signal at the epithelium that signals the SOS. So my thought on this, you know, just pure conjecture, but it must have a special role in pathophysiology for both asthma and CSU potentially, although it failed to meet its primary endpoint. Here's the case study that sponsored ignited everything. This is one of the many patients that failed omalizumab in my practice. This patient, I threw everything, and including the kitchen sink at her, nothing really helped. So she's actually patient 2 in this case series of the dupilumab that I published. And you know, we have a drug called ketotifen, a mast cell stabilizer in Canada that we use for asthma sometimes. But she had all been also on dapsone, rupatadine, which is another antihistamine, PAF antagonist we have in Canada. Nothing worked for her. She had a bit of mild eczema. We see that the other patients were just like her. There's many of these patients, you know, at the point of doing this, probably had over 100 who failed to respond to omalizumab. So we tried the dupilumab, and you know, within about 3 to 4 months, most of them got significantly better. And I got this idea from studies on omalizumab. So omalizumab, people think of it as mainly an IgE blocker, but it also affects granulocyte, colony stimulating factor. Again, the cell is asking for reinforcement, so it actually stops this process in omalizumab. IL-13 can get affected in responders to omalizumab as well. So clearly type 2 cytokines are involved in the process of CSU, as well as the self-antibody. All right, in summary, about half your patients will not respond to 4 times antihistamine dosing. And of those you get on omalizumab, about 30 to 60% will not respond either. This is just unfortunately the reality. Other treatment options are needed. Biologics have really opened up our understanding, and you know, other things will come out and others will be in development. This is a very exciting time. It is a challenge to define the phenotype and corresponding endotype. So what's really driving the phenotype of this patient? Biomarkers can lead to more accurate targeted therapies, but we are still improving our knowledge of CSU. Those patients, by the way, of the 6, 4 out of the 6 continue to be in remission, and we had just published this about 6 months ago. And the other 2 had a recurrence, but they're very, very difficult patients. And I've essentially asked every single dermatologist and allergist at a conference what to do, and no one really knows. So if you have any ideas, I'd be happy to hear.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Levien. I'd say that was a swell presentation. Great, and I want to thank you all for being with us. There's some questions here from the group, so we'll start with some of the questions here. as anti-IgE helps chronic spontaneous urticaria, what specifically does the IgE react with, and what is the role of autologous skin test to patients' serum in these cases? Any thoughts on that?
The IgE, if you're using omalizumab, okay, binds to what's called the C3 domain of the IgE receptor. And, you know, at this part of the domain, it's also a regulatory domain. So you got some blocking. And over time, the expression of FcεR1 actually goes down on mast cells over time. The less activation of the mast cell, you got less of the stem cell factor, less of the propagation, and less reinforcements. So the mechanism is multifactorial, but one of the things is blocking the potentially the autologous self-antibodies, but also down-regulating the receptor over time, so you get less hive activity and less mast cell activation. The second part of the question is, you know, autologous serum testing. You know, I think some people may still do it, and it really would be an academic interest. But, you know, would it affect management is the question that I ask myself for any laboratory investigation. And I think for me, at least, the answer is no. It wouldn't affect how I treat this patient. So, you know, it's also a very cumbersome procedure to do. You've got to take the blood, spin down the serum, and re-inject.
Great, great. We have a few other ones. There's some from our virtual audience as well. I think I'll combine two of them together. One is, does pretreatment total IgE predict omalizumab response? And related to that, is there a clinical way to predict which patients will respond better to omalizumab versus dupilumab or vice versa?
Okay, very good questions, I think. The total IgE, there are some studies that show that, you know, more IgE has higher burden of, you know, and the dosing may need to be adjusted with omalizumab. This is very interesting, though, because for me, when I read these studies, the IgE levels were not controlled for by other extraneous variables, such as systemic corticosteroid exposure, which can affect IgE levels with a shift from one body space to another. So there's a few unknowns. Most of the IgE in your body is actually tissue-bound in the tissue. So the serum is not the best reflector of total body IgE, but it's sometimes a rough proxy. So yes, I guess, you know, a long-winded way to say that occasionally, yes, a very high IgE could mean a more refractory course to anti-IgE therapy. The second question, remind me, sorry.
Are there any tests clinically to predict which patient will respond better to dupilumab versus omalizumab?
Okay, that's a very good question. Currently, the ones that would be accessible to the average, you know, physician, the answer would be no. But potentially in the future, cytokine measurements are actually very difficult to do. Okay, and of course, you know, genome sequencing is also very hard to do. Some of my patients, independently wealthy, decide to do it, and we find interesting things like single nucleotide polymorphisms or, you know, polymorphic expression of eotaxin or other factors that may affect more type 2 inflammation. However, I don't think this is really accessible to the average physician and patient, so currently not so much, but I think in the future I'm hopeful, always an optimist.
Yeah, and if I could add, so I think, you know, given the percentage of patients that may not respond as much to omalizumab, I know that this talk is mainly focused on biologics for patients with CSU, but there are also a number of oral therapies that are in development, for example, BTK inhibitors that may target both the autoallergic as well as autoimmune kind of etiologies of CSU and may therefore hopefully be able to potentially have efficacy for a larger patient population or a wider array of phenotype. But I think hopefully the phase 3 data from those development will help us inform of that. So in addition to the oral to the biologic therapies, I think with the oral therapies that are in development, I think we have hopefully good treatment for CSU in the future.
Absolutely. Blocking more parts of the different ways to the path of CSU, whether it be type 1 or type 2 inflammatory, may sometimes be needed in some patients.
Yes. There's an audience member here asks that how often are ketotifen or cromolyn helpful in treating CSU, as you know, we derms don't tend to use that as much?
Very good question. A lot of patients refuse ketotifen too for the side effect of, you know, pretty profound weight gain. Although the Barnograph does state it, most patients do gain a considerable weight and nobody wants to gain weight. In terms of its effectiveness, patients do find it very surprisingly helpful. In some, you know, Asian countries, they have another drug that's a mast cell stabilizer too, called olopatadine. I think you have it available here as an eye drop and in Canada as well. But this does come as an oral form, and the mast cell stabilization sometimes adds a little bit extra. But when you look at clinical studies on CSU, it's not significantly better than antihistamines. But anecdotally, I do see sometimes that it works where antihistamine alone would fail.
Great. And I think our last question, what is the best treatment strategy for sporadic exacerbations of CSU, which can be severe? I have a few thoughts on this, but I definitely want to hear your thoughts as well, Dr. Lee. I think, you know, when we're considering, for example, elevating therapy for omalizumab from, let's say, four times the dose of antihistamines, oftentimes what I do is that even when I start omalizumab, I will keep the antihistamines there. So sometimes if you try to stop that and start the omalizumab, you actually may see sometimes a worsening in some of the patients. So having that overlap is important. And for exacerbation, so I typically start omalizumab actually at 300 milligrams Q4 weeks. The indication is for 150 or 300. So I tend to start at 300 Q4 weeks, and with their stable dose of second generation antihistamine, and see how they do. And then typically that would have pretty good get patients in good control. Now, if they don't respond to that, then I can see if I can add up to twice the dose of omalizumab. Some of the guidelines support 600 milligrams of omalizumab Q4 weeks, so something that one could do to help control some of the sporadic exacerbation in the especially severe patients. Any thoughts on
that? Yeah, so there's obviously a lot of individual variation in practice. I essentially do what you do. We have a trial called Optima that we did at our center, and it was a pretty multi-center trial. And what we see is that the 300 dose is, you know, almost always better. I almost never use 150 because of this data. And that, but I do think there is something to be said about going up to the 600 milligram dose, because our center's experience and a few other centers, we are trying to accumulate this data. We don't find that it makes much of a difference significantly. It's very different from what's published out there, showing that increasing to 600 does actually make a difference. We don't find that it significantly does so. So, going to 600 may help for some patients. It's worth a try, but, perhaps this is an indication or a signal, a clinical response, that maybe they have some other form of inflammation driving their hives, and we need a more pleiotropic approach to treating them. So, kind of my approach there.
Wonderful. Great. I want to especially thank Dr. Lee, our allergist immunologist, for joining us tonight.
I hope
you had a good time with
absolutely.
Us derms here. And thank you, and please enjoy the rest of the conference. Take care.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/RFB860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Sanofi and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals.